This is the Last Week in English podcast, Summer Semester 2019, Week 9, with me, Mark Jacob, coming to you from the TU Berg Academy Freiburg. Today's guest comes from the small town of Lauchhammer in Brandenburg, a mere 60 miles or 100 kilometers away from Freiburg. Her journey here, however, was much longer, with long stop-offs in California, various locations in Germany, and also northern Italy. She obtained a bachelor's degree in history and a master's in international relations from the University of San Diego, USA, and a PhD from Mannheim on the relations between East and West German research institutes. On top of that, she received a basketball scholarship at San Diego and played professionally in Italy and Germany and represented the German national team 21 times. She's currently a research associate at the Institute of Industrial Archaeology and the History of Science and Technology, carrying out research in uranium mining in East Germany from 1949 to 1990. To discuss all this and more, I'm delighted to welcome Sabine Löwe-Hanatsch.
Hello, nice to meet you.
But before we talk about what you're doing right now here at the TU Freiburg, could you tell us a little bit about your background?
Of course. I was born in Lauchhammer, a little small town in the south of Brandenburg, and I grew up there with my family and my brother. After going to school there and going to the gymnasium, after 2 years, I changed the schools and went to the boarding school in Halle-Saale, a specific school for sports, and I was able to train multiple times a day. After finishing school, I decided that I wanted to go to the university, but didn't really know where and what to do, which subjects to study. And so I began studying at the University of Halle-Saale. My subjects were history and Russian. And after 1 year, I received an athletic scholarship from the University of San Diego and decided to accept it. Although I only wanted to stay for 1 year, I ended up staying 4 years in the nice city of San Diego.
Okay, so it's taken us all the way from Brandenburg to Saxony-Anhalt to San Diego, California. Maybe you can tell us a little bit how it was arriving in California.
Oh, yes. Before that, I had never been to the US, and deciding to go to San Diego, I didn't expect it to be such a big city with more than 5 million inhabitants. So that was a big shock, but all the people were really nice and accepted me right away. And of course, the start at the university studying history was, at least for the first months, was difficult because of all the special terms in the subjects. But I had a basketball team around me, which helped to manage life. And so after a couple months, I find myself in a really comfortable situation, practicing twice a day, having games, traveling a lot, and I just enjoyed the time at the university.
Were your teammates from the US or were some from Europe like you?
I was the only one from Europe, but on other sports teams, there were a lot of European, like in the soccer team, there were Swedish players, and in the tennis team, there was an Irish girl. So there was a little European community within the whole sports direction district. That helped a lot just to interchange and to communicate and to talk about their experience. And
how good was your English when you arrived?
When I arrived, I only I learned English in school. I had to pass SAT and the TOEFL test to be accepted at the university, but I was definitely not really prepared for it. But having no German-speaking people around myself, I was forced to learn the language really quick and really good. And when you're forced to talk the language, you learn it really quick. And it helps a lot to not to speak German with other people. It's even if I wasn't a perfect speaker, it was no handicap to go there, and it didn't limit my exchange because the Americans love people talking with accents and with speaking with a broken English. They love them and they're always friendly to you.
So how much of your time then was spent studying and how much playing basketball and training?
It was different because the schedule for practicing was set. We practiced usually twice a day, having weights and lifting in the morning, like an hour and a half doing the athletic program. And in the afternoon, we did the basketball practice, usually 2.5 hours. So that was set every day. And I was a fairly good student, so it was easy to me to study and I didn't have to put a lot of time into studying it. But when we have the exams, of course, you spend a lot of time in the evening and to study and to learn. It always depended when you have your classes, but I would say it was half and half. Mm-hmm. Half. You basically spend the same amount of time practicing than you need for learning and studying.
And sport at an American university is very highly regarded. Did it feel special being on the basketball team?
For me, when I came there, I didn't know that it had such a high rank at the university, but I noticed it really quickly because everyone knows you and everyone is saying hello at the campus. Even you don't know the people, but they know that you play basketball. How, if you win or lose, they know everything about you and the team. So you're kind of popular. And of course, you always wear clothes from the basketball team, so everyone recognizes you, which is nice because to get the experience to that the athletics and that sport is highly accepted, which you don't really have at the German universities. Mm-hmm. So it's not part of the university doing athletics. And in the US, it's part of the system of the whole university construction. And it's a lot because you represent the university outside of San Diego. And that's why they get a really good feedback mm-hmm. about their athletics.
Did you have to travel a lot then to games?
Yes, because that was a really nice part about my experience because going to away games, you had to travel. The closest away game was in Los Angeles. Yeah. That was the only time we went by bus because the teams in our league were located all around the West Coast from Seattle to Portland and San Francisco and Bay Area down to San Diego. So it's a long distance and we basically flew to all the games. And in preseason, you can schedule games all around over the US. So we went to Kansas and Atlanta. And that was a nice part because I got to see all the cities and all the different parts of the US. Not paying for it yeah. because we went to a game. So.
Did you have any favorite cities in the US?
I have to think about it, but I really liked San Francisco. That was really nice. Mm. But each city has something because they're really different going from the West Coast to the East Coast or even in the Midwest near Chicago, which is really German-like. Mm-hmm. So each city has its own symbols, but definitely San Francisco and the Bay Area, probably because of Alcatraz.
No. The prison.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Before you went to the US, you did do 2 semesters, you said, in Halle.
Yes.
So what would you say were the differences between studying in the US and in Germany?
Yeah, there are a lot of differences, but in my opinion, the main differences are that in the US, the whole study is more practical. You get much more practical experience coming from the background of an historian. You have to go to archives, to conferences, work in the library, and technically work in your field. Which in Germany, you are more concentrated about learning, learning from books and doing literature researches. That is one of the big differences. And another difference is that the schedule of the semester is more planned in the US than in Germany. In Germany, you have to work more on your own to get all the contents done. In the US, it's planned. Each week is planned. Each appointment is set at the beginning of the semester. So these, I would say, are the main differences. And another difference about the entire university system is the selection. I think that not everyone can go to the university. You have to pass an exam at the end of the school. Like, and each student in the US has to pass the, it's the same exam for everyone, and you get a, you reached a number, like points from, maybe you reached 980 from 1,000 points, and then it will be combined with your grades from school, and that gives you a number, number X, and then you apply to the universities, and they go from back from the highest number to the lowest. And they only have a certain amount of places. And if they only have 150 places for new students, they only take 150 students. And then if you don't have enough points to be one of the first 150, they won't accept you.
Right.
That's so there's a lot of more selection being done. But that's a different, that's of the entire education system, that's a difference.
Right.
Yes.
And one, another difference is the this paying, that in the States you have high fees for university. I don't know how much it is at the University of San Diego.
Yes. It's the University of San Diego is a Catholic school, so it's considered a private school. You have, in the US, you have to pay for private and public schools. It's nothing even comparable to Germany. And it was over $40,000 a year. And I could have never paid for it unless without the scholarship. Yes. So that's a huge difference. And usually the public schools and universities are around $15,000 a year, which is a big difference, but it's still really expensive compared to Germany.
So it was great that you got the scholarship.
Yes, but definitely.
Were there any downsides to it, to being in the athletics program?
Yes, you, well, I wouldn't consider, or I wouldn't consider it a downside, but you have a lot of pressure on yourself and a lot of competition within the team, a lot of competition between the coaches and the players. And you have to perform. You have to perform every day. If you don't feel good, it doesn't matter. You have to perform. And in the athletics, it doesn't matter if it's basketball or American football, you have to reach a certain grade average or you're not allowed to practice and play. So you need to be good at school in order to play. And if you're not good at school, you can't play. So they don't need you anymore because a player that can't play is senseless.
Yeah.
So the pressure is not a downside, but a hard fact.
Right.
I would consider it. Even the pressure you put on your own body, that is really hard. And you don't have the choice, or it's not, you can't decide to take time off because the coaches decide. Okay. After 7 or 8 days, now you have a day off. And you can't decide it on your own, even you want to. That's something you either can deal with it or not.
Yeah.
And otherwise you don't get along.
Okay. But you came through it and you graduated, you did your undergrad there, as you say, in history, and then masters in international relations. And you didn't pick up any major injuries. Is that right? So, so after that, having got all that great experience, then you came back to Europe. What did you do next?
Well, I have to say before, I had the option to stay in the US, but I always wanted to come back. Mm. Definitely not even to Germany, but back to Europe. And I decided to play professional basketball and went to Bozen in northern Italy, which was a completely different experience from the cultural perspective, even from a sports perspective. But it was also just as good as the experience in the US.
What was different then when you got to Italy?
The Italian people are more relaxed. You don't have that much pressure on yourself. And of course, you have to go to practice and have to participate and have to compete. But it's much less pressure and you get paid for it. They pay fairly good in Italy. And you had a lot of free time. Because the only thing you do is playing basketball, like practicing twice a day, and then you have the day off. Which is, after a year, it gets really boring. So because, me personally, I miss the intellectual competition.
Right, if you came from the States where you were spending the rest of your time basically studying when you weren't playing, then you had the same without the studying than in Italy.
And so that was later on at a point of my decision to go to do the PhD program. And another fact in Italy, which is really different, which I loved, was the food. Being in northern Italy, you had both. You had German food and you had Italian food. And that was great. You could eat whatever you wanted and it always tasted really good. So that was a really nice experience.
Yeah. And you said that you had a lot of free time in Italy. Mm-hmm. What did you do in your free time?
Well, in the first year, I intensively learned Italian because I had no German-speaking players around me and I wanted to communicate with them and I wanted to read the newspapers and the reports about the games. And so that took a lot of time to learn Italian. And I found another person, a young man who wanted to learn German. So we did a tandem program, which is really helpful. And he showed me a lot of architecture and culture around. So, but then after two, and I stayed 3 years in my third year, I visited a French course. But then I came to the point that I really wanted to go back to the university and doing research and or doing my PhD. And in northern Italy, you can go hiking
a lot,
which is nice. So you are able to spend the time and you fulfill it with something, but you don't have really intellectual discussions or about the thing you studied and, and you initially wanted to do.
Right. And did you go straight from there to doing PhD?
No, I went back to Germany and I played another season in Nördling, which is close to Augsburg in Munich, in order to really decide what I wanted to do and to search for the universities where I can do my PhD program. And I also was able in that year to rejoin with two San Diego players that also came to Europe to play in Germany in Nördling, which was great to do a little reunion. After that year, I decided to stop playing basketball professionally, just to do it as a hobby, to do it once a week or whatever, and decided to do the PhD program in Mannheim.
Was that difficult to retire?
Yes. It was very hard because, I don't know how to describe it, but when you always practice and train, you don't notice the pain in your body. And when you stop playing, after a couple months, you notice your knees are hurting. And it took me a while to get into a different mode, a different, like, doing sports, but not on such a high level. And even, I'm still missing going to away games, and I'm... I think another really hard point is I definitely miss the competition, the athletic competition. I never regretted the step to do it because I had so much to do with the PhD program and getting to know new people and being back to the university that I never had a lot of time to think about it and question my decision. And it was hard for my family because they loved to come to games and watch me play. And now there was no chance to see me play anymore. Yeah. So
because you got to the highest level, I mentioned that in the introduction, but
yes.
I didn't ask you about it now. But, you also played for the German national team.
Yes.
How was that? How did that compare to just college basketball?
Well, it's definitely different representing your country. Mm. The same thing is that you travel a lot and you visit. The distance are probably the same, but in Europe, you're in a different country, and in the US, you're in a different state. Yeah, it's you have the formal perspective on it. You represent a country and you have to wear the uniform. So that is different, but it's the same sport. It's the same competition. The other countries are just as good as college basketball, even better. I did it 1.5 summer, and then I had the option to return or to continue doing it, but I decided to completely focus on my academic career. But it also I love playing with the girls, and a lot of them I knew from before going to the US. Yeah.
Right. So you focused on your academic career then. It was also, your PhD was also in international relations. Is that right?
Yes. I did my master's program on international relations. And then in my PhD, the research was about East and West German research institutions and their contacts and their work together, which in the 1970s and 80s, when Germany was still divided into two different countries. And that took me 5 years because I have family plans in between. But I definitely wanted to do an internationally or German topic, just because to compare two perspectives. Yes, to compare it and to see how people from different parts think and how they can work together or not. What are the advantages, the disadvantages, the problems, and how they deal with different cultural backgrounds and social and different society systems. And that was a really good experience because I was able to do interviews with formerly representatives of the research institutes. So therefore, I became a really good insight of the institutions and their work. So it was a really interesting topic. And my book got published this in April.
Oh, great.
So finally.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
It's kind of surprising to hear that in the 70s and 80s, you know, the height of the Cold War, maybe it wasn't quite the height, maybe, that there was such cooperation between East and the West.
Yes, that's a question that I hear a lot, because that is true. I have to say that the cooperation in other fields, there was no cooperation, but in the field of foreign policy and security policy, they had to talk to each other because they were in the same situation. In any case of war, Germany would have been destroyed no matter what. And not only East or West Germany, both, because probably multiple times going back and forth on the front. So they had to talk to each other and try to limit the danger of a war breaking out. But on the field, like journalists or teachers or economists, they didn't have the freedom to travel as much as these security experts did, or to talk freely. And so, yes, I have to answer, yes, there was a limited amount of contacts, but in the field of foreign policy, there were a lot of contacts, which was on a kind of semi-official level. So I was never on a high official level, so probably on the second level.
Right. It feels very important for people from different countries, even countries that are maybe not so friendly towards each other, to really talk to each other.
Definitely. And it shows a way how you, even if you have different understandings of society or culture or politics, you have to find a way to work to each other, because at the end, it's in the case of East and West Germany, at the end, they have both had the same problem they had to deal with, no matter what. It's a good blueprint for North and South Korea.
Yeah.
Like, they could learn from the mistakes we made in the progress in the process of reunification. And I'm sure, I'm not an expert on it, but I'm sure they have kind of the same context in between, just to deal with the same situation. So it's important for a lot of countries, in my opinion, and for a lot of situations.
And it's very important that historians are looking at these situations from the past, because we could learn a lot from them. Yes. That's what you're saying.
Yes, exactly. And not just learning, but looking in the past, we are able to prevent doing the same mistakes, and we are able to learn from it and not do it again and again, which is politically questionable because it happens all the time. But technically or theoretically, we should all be able to learn from it and do it better in the next situation.
Well, let's hope that the Koreans read your book.
Yes.
Now you're in Freiburg.
Yes.
Here, and your topic, you've changed topics, but you're still looking at that era. Is that right?
Yes. It's the same era. The topic is different, but the topic is about the uranium mining in the GDR.
Mm-hmm.
And especially what kind of environmental problems did create it, and how did the government and even the Wismut deal with it, or even did they deal with it? And what
Wismut is, then could you just explain what that is?
Yes, the Wismut was the mining company, the uranium mining company, which was kind of a joint venture. Today we would say a joint venture of East Germany and Russia. And so that was the company. And they, of course, they had to deal with the problems. And my focus is to look into the archives and into the documents. Even the first question, did they notice it?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I would assume they notice it. And then did they take measures to limit the pollution, the air, water, or soil pollution? What kind of measures and how successful was it?
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe they didn't even take any measures. But it's considering that it was an East German and Russian company, so it's again an international project. The topic is international. And I also have to look how it was recognized and participated by the West Germans. So I still have to look on both sides, East and West Germany, and put it into an international framework, because it was a company that produced the uranium mining for the Russian nuclear weapons during the Cold War. So even it's on the first view, it seems to be an East German topic. It's an international, in my opinion, has an international framework to it.
Right. What are you expecting to learn from this project?
I expect to learn from it that, first of all, that you get to the point, even if it's the same with coal mining and other mining industry, to recognize what it does to the landscape, what kind of pollutions it has, and what's the result for the entire environment around it, and then to deal with it and how to recultivate it. And it's a topic at the point, because considering that in 2038 the coal mining will be stopped in Germany. We need to develop models and processes how to recultivate and deal with the problems it has. And that's the point. We can look what happened before. And even there are other uranium mining areas in the world. And I'm pretty sure they have the same problems with the pollution, and to find a way out of it and to make it livable areas again.
Right. Back then, the political situation was very different than the one-party state system. Yes. And nowadays, politicians have to worry about what the voters think. So did the politicians back then and the people in power, did they have to worry about what people thought? Was that a driver? Or what was the big driver for protecting the environment?
Well, that's the question of the project.
Right.
If there even was a drive for protecting the environment, that's what I still have to research on it. But what we have to think about it then is, even it was in East Germany, the Russians had much more power to dictate the East Germans how to mine the uranium and what to do with the uranium. So the control of the whole situation was not completely in the hands of the East German government. So that's, even it was the information back to the population. There was rare information, and they didn't really get a lot of information. And it started in the mid-80s, when the environmental situation in Eastern Germany became much more focus, and environmental groups were established and protested against the whole situation. But before then, there was no few consideration of the government about the environment. I'm not sure if it really was that way, or if they just don't have had the chance to, or the money to control it and to recultivate. That's a question I have to answer and have to research on.
And where are you going to be getting the data then for your research?
I'm getting it from the archives, from the local archives, in Chemnitz or in Thuringen, also from the federal archives in Berlin, and another important archive is the Stasi archive. And one part of the research project will be to go to the Russian archives to get the Russian perspective, since it was a joint company. So that's the main information. That's where I get the main information. And then really small local archives, or and even interviews.
Right.
Interviews with former workers.
Yeah.
Or directors from the Wismut. Depends who's still living or who's willing to do an interview with
me. Okay. Well, Stasi, that's the secret or secret police, as we could say.
Yes,
or
the secret service.
Secret service.
Of the state, which controlled and really focused on people that were protesting against the situation. And I haven't looked into these documents yet.
Yeah.
I will do it in January.
Yeah. And you mentioned Moscow, then you're going to Russia to look through the archives. And you said at the beginning that you started learning or started studying Russian in Halle. How good is your Russian now?
I'm in the process of reactivating because I had it at school for 7 years. Mm-hmm. I learned it at school for 7 years and then 3 semesters at the University of Halle. And then I didn't use it for 5-6 years, and now I decided to reactivate it. And reading and understanding texts and essays is much, much easier than talking, which I consider is the biggest problem, because it probably is easy for me, or easy or not such a big problem, to read the documents, but I have to talk to the people working in the archives and have to explain them in Russian what I want from them and which documents I need to get, and give them information. So this will be a huge challenge, right. Definitely. Yeah. But I still have a year to prepare.
And like you say, you'll be working with documents, but also with people. Mm. And with learning a language, it is about getting information across and communicating, but it's also feel about making a, let's say, connection with the people. Maybe they'll find some extra documents for you, you know, if you make a good connection.
Yes, these were also my experience, because even you can read the documents mm-hmm. and analyze them, but the information's in between the lines mm. will give you the people, and they explain, that's what I, every time I did an interview with for my PhD, they can explain in detail what is written in the document, and they can put it in a framework, and so that you get much more insight to it, and you can structure it in your research and know, okay, now that's the point of the document. You understand the document reading it, and you can place it within your research, but the detailed information, which is probably mostly the more worthfully information. So to me, it's always important to talk to these people.
Yeah. And you've been taking Russian lessons, is that right?
Yes. Yeah, at the university.
Here at the university in the Language Center. And how was that?
That is a really nice experience. On one side, of course, to learn Russian and to reactivate it, but also to get to know other students from other subjects and other fields, which is really nice. And also I asked them, why do they take a Russian course? And I always find it interesting to know why people learn different languages. And just to get, because in my work, I don't have to deal with students. I only do my own work. And so it's a chance for me to get in contact with students from the university and to get an insight from their ideas and perspectives. So other than only having the academic, from the academics. So it's a good experience for me to learn Russian and get a lot out of it on the social side.
Right. Because you're here a couple of days a week, is that right? 2 or 3 days a week.
Yes.
And you also work from home. And your home for you means then Lauchhammer, you're back in Lauchhammer where you began.
Yes. The circle is closed.
Yeah.
I met my husband in Lauchhammer, and we decided to stay there, and the whole family is there, and so it was easy to decide to work outside of Lauchhammer, and which is only possible if I had the chance to do home office, and I couldn't manage it to come here every day a week.
Right.
But so I love, it's my hometown, and even I spent 15 or 16 years away from my hometown, I always had the feeling coming back, and I enjoy life there, and I got a lot of experience from the world, and it's important to me that I did this, and personally, and it makes for me a lot of situations in life I can analyze them from a different perspective and with different background informations, and it's easy for me to understand different people from different cultures, from different lifestyles, and it's much easier to accept that people are not have the same life like you, or do have a different life and have different ways in life. So I think it was really important to go abroad and to get this experience just for my character and for my personal development.
So it sounds like, yeah, that was important in a number of ways, going abroad. Yeah. So you'd recommend to students then studying abroad?
Yes, definitely. Go abroad. It's not just about studying at the different university, about the actual subject studying. It's about people, it's about getting to know different cultures, different societies, and when you come back, you will see your hometown or your country and political situations from a different perspective. And would recognize and suggest everyone should do it, and I definitely, I highly recommend it.
Right, and you learn a lot of languages on the way
yes,
as well.
That's on the way. That's not even the main focus,
yeah.
But you have to, and
yeah.
That's a really good byproduct for your for applying for jobs and
yeah.
for your future career.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much for telling us all
yes.
about this, about your experiences. So thank you very much, Sabine Löwe-Hanac, and all the best with your work here in Freiburg and your family.
Thank you. Thanks for being here and having the chance to give the interview. Thanks.